Chapter 18, Union versus Evangelical Belief. For Edith Brown, religious faith was the keystone of existence. From that faith sprang her motivation for service. That faith energized her to attempt the seemingly impossible. In that faith, she found a solution to every problem. In 1919, life became very difficult in the Punjab because of riots and general unrest. It was unsafe for women to travel, so the number of patients in the hospital was drastically reduced. This was particularly true among the wealthier patients who were afraid of robbery and looting. Consequently, the private wards, which usually brought in several thousand rupees a year, were quite empty. The financial situation at the hospital became grave, so the doctor turned to her faith for an answer. We had special prayer about finance. Then I received a special call to go up to Simla to see a Rani who was expecting her confinement. She had four mothers-in-law, four widows of her father-in-law. They all declared, according to their custom, that the baby would arrive in August, while in my opinion it would not arrive until September. But I asked to go up in August and stay until the baby arrived, and they were willing to pay 300 rupees per day. I took up with me one of our younger doctors, who was not very well, and arranged that I should come down to Ludhiana for Wednesday and Thursday of each week to perform necessary operations, and they would pay 100 rupees for the junior doctor for these days. Finally, the baby was born in September, and we received 14,000 rupees in fees. Our financial needs were met in a very wonderful way. From its inception, the school had been a channel of faith dedicated to the proclamation of the gospel of Christ through well-trained medical workers who would come from varied backgrounds and go out to serve in many denominational institutions. The emphasis on interdenominational cooperation was stressed in the first report issued in 1895. Whilst possessing a separate organization, it is only by the cooperation of the various societies that it can be successful, that both in its inception and organization it has been formed by delegates from nearly all the missions working in these districts, and that in every way possible it is desired to maintain intimate connection with them, that it should have been able at once to enlist the cordial sympathy and aid of representatives of so many branches of the Church of Christ is strong evidence of the felt need for such an institution and a ground for confidence in their continued support and cooperation. It is only in this way that the effort can be successful, and the cooperation of all Christian missionary societies, both in the control and support of the school, is most earnestly desired. Dr. Brown participated in and urged full interdenominational activity in the medical field. At the time of the medical conference at Calcutta in 1895, she agreed to serve as one of the editors for the newly established magazine Medical Missions in India. This responsibility she carried for a number of years. She also helped organize the Punjab branch of the Medical Mission Association and opened the facilities of the school for some of their meetings. Her evaluation of such cooperation is seen in her report for the year 1910. In the summer, it was thought well that the school should be represented at the World Missionary Conference in Edinburgh, so I had the pleasure of a short visit home and of being present at that wonderful convention. In summarizing the findings of the conference, she quoted, "Their unanimous opinion that in the Christian Medical College now being established in increasing numbers in China and elsewhere, the fullest cooperation possible between the missions working in any particular region is eminently desirable, and that not only because of the spiritual gain which is sure to accompany union, but also for the purpose of economy, efficiency, and permanency in the preparation of native workers for the medical missionary field." Dr. Brown expressed her own thoughts about this. "May we not look for the expression of these great principles not only in word but in actual fact? If the missionary societies heartily unite, if they join in having good and thoroughly equipped hospitals, what a difference it will make to medical work as a whole. And in particular, what incalculable difference it will make to us if all will join actively in the support and supply of this medical school. It was started in the full hope and expectation of hearty cooperation among all societies and denominations, and until that hope and expectation are realized, we feel that our work, however successful, fails of what it should be its supreme triumph, the practical demonstration of what may be done for our Master by those who have learned what it is to be one, even as He and the Father are one. The spiritual nature of the work received notice from varying quarters. In 1904, Pandita Ramabai wrote, "The science of medicine is a dangerous instrument in the hands of persons who have no fear of God before their eyes. Our women who are just coming to light and knowledge ought to be helped by Christian people providing medical training and education conducted on Christian principles. I hope that Christian Friends of India's Women will take up this work and help Dr. Brown and others who are laboring to give medical help and Christian medical training to India's women in accordance with God's will and word." In 1910, the Women's Society of the Presbyterian Church in Canada passed a resolution supporting the school. The board of the WFMS, having learned more particularly of the Ludhiana School of Medicine for Women in North India, desired to express to our Women's Mission Council their sympathy with this institution and their appreciation of its position as an interdenominational center for the training of Native Christian women as physicians to their own people. As such an institution, we feel it should have the support and sympathy of all women's missionary societies at work in India. From many other quarters came appeals for and pledges of support. In 1912, the National Conference in Calcutta, in connection with the Continuation Committee of the World Missionary Conferences, included an appeal for support for the Ludhiana School in its findings. This conference finds that the cooperation of the various mission bodies is urgently required for the training of Indian Christian women for all grades of medical service. In this connection, attention is directed to the work and claims of the Women's Christian Medical College in Ludhiana, an interdenominational institution already in existence for the service of all missions, and appealing to all for more united support. In February 1914, the Medical Missionary Association recognized the school as a representative training institution under the purposes of the association and recommended that it be eligible for assistance from the Edinburgh Medical Missionary Society. The Edinburgh Society gave its cordial assent to the recommendations and arranged some scholarship assistance. In February 1915, the Standing Committee of the Church of England's Zenana Missionary Society in Amritsar recommended the medical college as a worthy object for cooperation and suggested a scholarship payment of 360 rupees per year. Also in 1915, the Punjab Representative Council of Missions emphasized the importance of the institution and called on all the missionary societies in North India to provide financial support and nominate members to the governing committee. The following year, Dr. Brown was co-opted as a member of the Representative Council on Missions. The 1916 annual report underscored the interdenominational makeup of the school. The governing body represents 11 different missionary societies, besides having representatives from various branches of government civil service. The teaching staff represents 5 denominations, while the students in training had their education in or were sent by 16 different missionary societies. From this, it must be clear to all that the Women's Christian Medical College Ludhiana is not a denominational institution, but a union one. The London Auxiliary Committee, in the meantime, had begun to think in terms of a more organic union, which would bring widespread support for the school from a larger number of denominations. Discussions were held in London with Dr. Brown when she was on furlough in 1920, and a full report was forwarded to the General Committee in India. That body convened on November 10, 1920, and studied the report of the union scheme. The result was that a unanimous vote was taken to approve the plan, and this message was sent to London. We are in full agreement with the resolution of the British Advisory Board and are willing for the college to be taken over as a union institution on the terms laid down and on the basis of confidence that the continuity of evangelical teaching will be assured. The terms laid down was referred to the London Auxiliary Committee's minutes of October 4, 1920, where the discussion concerned the basis of union for the Women's Christian College Madras and the Shantung Christian University. However, the General Committee pointed out the basis of the Madras College was a Christian education for women, but Ludhiana stood for more, i.e., to give young women such training as would imbue them with the missionary spirit and fit them to be missionaries to their own people. The London Auxiliary entered into negotiations with the British Advisory Board on medical missions of the British Conference of Missionary Societies, requesting that the college be brought into closer union with the societies working in India. The advisory board appointed a distinguished committee to confer with the representatives of the college in India and to consult with the Medical Missionary Association and mission councils in India with a final report to London. The personal religious faith of Edith Brown now became a pivotal force in the negotiations. She demanded a safeguard for the evangelical teachings which she had held forth for the previous 26 years and which had been the very foundation of all the work carried on in the institution. The London Auxiliary again communicated with the British Advisory Board. We have learned that a union board constituted under your auspices would desire to revise and reappoint the staff, which might involve practically the resignation of the present staff. We also feel more and more strongly that a religious basis should be assured in definite terms, and we understand a union board would be expected to admit to its membership the representatives of any one of the 20 or 30 societies of the conference who might wish at any time to join it. Our London committee thinks that these matters should be brought to the notice of the General Committee in India. The full discussion of the matter took place at the General Committee meeting in Ludhiana on March 30, 1921. By this time, Dr. Brown was back in India and was able to advance her point of view to the entire committee. The minutes of that meeting record the reasoning and decision of the group. The chief point round which discussion centered was as to whether, in confidence in the missions represented by the British Advisory Board of Medical Missions, 32 societies, including all the greater societies of Great Britain, we should ask them to take over the management of the institution, or whether we should have a defined theological basis, in which case the British Advisory Board taking up the matter would be out of the question. The alternative is a union of mission societies who would adhere to the defined theological basis. A motion was passed by a vote of 11-1 that the General Committee approve of the larger union scheme under the British Advisory Board of Medical Missions and wish it to be carried through. Dr. Brown cast the one dissenting vote and offered her resignation. The General Committee requested the London Advisory to ask the advisory board to take over the work, effective from October 1922, and to search for a new principal to replace Dr. Brown. A draft of union was drawn up by the executive committee and presented to the general committee on January 26, 1922. It received unanimous approval and was mailed out to the members of the society for recorded vote. At this meeting, Miss Rose Greenfield and Dr. J.C.R. Ewing were once again welcomed as members of the General Committee. Both had been signatories of the original Constitution in 1896 and would be required to vote on the proposed union scheme. The proposed draft of union carried with it a historical statement of origin, basis, and objectives. These stated, 1. The Women's Christian Medical College had been established in Punjab for over 26 years, was registered as a joint stock company, and had for its main object the training of Indian Christian women as medical missionaries. 2. The principles upon which the work had from the beginning been conducted and which it was hoped would be continued were, A. Belief in the essential deity and in the incarnation of our Lord Jesus Christ, the absolute infallibility of his utterances as recorded in the scriptures, the all-sufficiency of his atoning death, his resurrection in the body, his ascension, and his personal coming again. B. The acceptance of the absolute truthfulness and authority of the Holy Scriptures. C. The principles of action being the love of God shed abroad in the heart by the Holy Ghost, obedience to the command of Christ, the desire that all others shall share the knowledge of his love. 3. The aims of the work were A. To provide medical training for those who feel called to take up medical missionary work. B. To train them as fully equipped Christian workers for the uplift of the womanhood of India. C. To promote their spiritual welfare by the study of God's Word, united prayer, and witness. And D. To provide medical training under Christian influence for such others as the Administrative Council may admit. Proposed draft of union was passed by the General Committee in January 1922, was approved by the signatories of the original Constitution and the contributing societies in November 1922. However, this draft was unacceptable to the British Advisory Board for Medical Missions and was rejected by them. In the interim period, a sharp division developed within the staff, extending to the junior staff and students. Two distinct factions had come into being, one in favor of union and the other against union. Every effort was made by the executive committee to restore harmony, but without success. In November 1922, it became evident that nothing short of complete reconstruction would avail. So a motion was passed by the general committee that the whole of the present staff be asked to hand in their resignations to the general committee to be held over until such time as a new principal be found, and that the present staff be open to re-election. All the staff sent in their resignations except Dr. Brown. This also was abandoned. The principal point of contention between Dr. Brown and the committee was the suggested date for her retirement. Committee members, after consultation with the Inspector General of Civil Hospitals, approached the doctor with the suggestion that she retire on her 60th birthday or her next furlough. Meanwhile, she would assist the committee in finding a suitable successor. This proposal did not meet with her approval. At the meeting of the committee in April 1923, four of the senior staff members tendered their resignations. The whole situation appeared out of control. An arbitration committee was decided upon at the suggestion of the Inspector General in order that an unbiased opinion be given on the whole situation. Before this group could meet, Dr. Brown shocked the community by issuing, on June 19, 1923, a printed circular headed to the members of the so-called General Committee of the Women's Christian Medical College. In this, she declared that, on the basis of legal advice, the governing body of the society was not the present so-called General Committee, but what was left of the list of 11 governors who were signatories of the original Memorandum of Association registered in 1896. That governing body was the real owner of all the property and monies of the society. It alone had the power to govern. It was true that this body did have power to legalize the status of the present General Committee, or they could create an entirely new one. However, Dr. Brown would not consent to any such action unless her demands were met. and these were: A, that I, as principal from the inception of the school and before the appointment of the committee and before the registration of the society in 1896, have the right to appoint and dismiss my staff, the reasons for dismissal to be given in detail in writing to the governing body; B, that I remain as principal as long as my health and faculties permit me to carry on the work, but that I may resign at any time on giving 6 months' notice; C, that the scheme for forming a union society with a basis of faith, agreed to by the General Committee and the original signatories and the contributing societies in January 1922, be proceeded with and carried through. Dr. Brown considered that she had been given an ultimatum by the General Committee, and she retorted with another, demanding acceptance within 15 days. The alternative would be judicial litigation. This blow had fallen upon the General Committee in the month of June, during the hot season when the members were scattered at many distant points for their vacation. It was therefore physically impossible to receive an answer from the entire body within 15 days. The president of the committee approached Dr. Brown with the question of having legal arbitration regarding the legal status of the General Committee. To this she replied with a terse statement, "No amount of arbitrators have it in their power to make legal that which is illegal." The Executive Committee, meeting on July 13, 1923, declared they could not accept Dr. Brown's conditions for these reasons. Demand A represents an extension of powers not provided for in our Constitution, nor in the rules and regulations, nor is it the usual custom in any similar institution. Demand B, in this, Dr. Brown claims to hold her appointment independent of any control whatsoever. Demand C, it is not clear as to what union scheme Dr. Brown refers as the union scheme agreed to by the General Committee in January 1922 and by the original signatories and contributing societies in November 1922 was rejected by the BABMM. All previous efforts during the past 3 years toward reconciliation and reconstruction had failed. Recognizing that the defense of their position in the law courts should be avoided at all costs, they resolved that all those members of the General Committee who disapprove of Dr. Brown's attitude of the governing body and her present unreasonable demands should resign in a body, publishing a manifesto explaining to contributing societies, auxiliaries, and government the reasons for so doing. The estrangement between the principal and the committee became even more pronounced. The principal wrote to the honorary treasurer, warning him against making payments to the order of the general or executive committee, as they were without legal status to so order. Furthermore, she decided to withhold all monies which came to her hand: government grants, contributing societies payments, auxiliary committees' transmissions or fees. When requested to give an accounting to the treasurer, she responded, "In reply to your request through Mr. Anderson, the honorary treasurer, for a statement of accounts, I would say that they are ready at any time for the original governing body. The cash will not be handed over, as it has been kept in my hands as principal, with the advice and approval of both the deputy commissioner and the IGCH." Arrangements were made to have Mr. Alfred Nundy, legal representative of the General Committee, and Mr. B. Bevan Petman, legal representative of Miss Brown, meet to discuss terms for a possible settlement. These were drawn up on August 13, 1923, and circulated to the General Committee members for study. Having been discussed and amended at the General Committee meeting on November 7, 1923, these terms were unanimously adopted. When referred to the principal for acceptance, she rejected them, saying, "I should like to know that the committee would undertake to appoint no new members on the staff or on the committee who could not truly sign the basis as a statement of their own personal belief. From statements I have heard made by certain members of the present General Committee, I fail to see how they can all sign it. As regards a date for my resignation, I see no reason for altering my opinion that, As I was not appointed to the committee has nothing to do with the date of my resignation. Doubtless, it will be made easier if the future of the work is assured on evangelical lines, but I decline to fix a date. Once again, Dr. Brown had managed to deadlock the situation. In order to find a way out of the impasse, the executive committee in April 1924 decided that probably the solution lay in consenting to adopt a new constitution. They called upon Mr. Calvert, registrar of stock companies in Punjab, to guide them out of the registration muddle in which they had found themselves. A subcommittee was selected to work with him and to discuss the proposed constitution with Dr. Brown. He had already been consulted by the principal and so was prepared for legal difficulties which had to be overcome. Mr. Calvert pointed out that, according to the registration of 1896, a society had been set up. A board of governors was set up to govern the society. These two had an especially favored position in law in comparison with the general committee, even though no meeting of the society had been held from the date of registration until the present time. The Board of Governors had not held a meeting from registration in 1896 until May 12, 1924. The Constitution was silent regarding the functions and powers of these governors. No provision was made for filling vacancies on the Board of Governors. Also set up was the General Committee, but this was under the rules and regulations, a document of lower legal order than the Memorandum of Association. It was to be self-perpetuating in part and representative in part, and it, not the society, had the responsibility to govern the school. No mention was made in the Constitution of any responsibility of this General Committee to render reports to any other body or to be subject to any other body. Mr. Calvert also stressed the fact that the Constitution did not assume any power for amendment. Therefore, it had to stand just as it was in 1896. All changes since then would be ultra vires, according to the constitutions adopted in 1913 and 1919 were legally inadmissible. So also were the changes involved in the amalgamation with the Punjab Medical School and the exemption from Bible study for non-Christians. In fact, the Constitution laid down that every student should be a member of a Protestant church. Hence, here was a vital defect. The change of name to Women's Christian Medical College was also ultra vires. In the eyes of the law and on the books of the Registrar of Stock Companies, the North India School of Medicine for Christian Women was still the official name. The General Committee had no power to change the Constitution. This was the prerogative of the Society rather than of a committee set up under the Constitution. But even the Society was powerless to change the Constitution. So the General Committee had to operate within the terms of the 1896 Constitution. The only solution provided for in the Act 21 of 1860 was for the original society to dissolve in favor of a new society and a new constitution. They must hand over their assets, liabilities, properties, and buildings to the new society, provided they were satisfied with the society, the Board of Governors, and the Constitution. Mr. Calvert, advising mutual compromise, drew up the working terms of a new constitution which had the sanction of Dr. Brown, the Inspector General of Civil Hospitals, and the government. When the new constitution was completed to the satisfaction of all parties, then the old governing body must lay it before the members of the society for their vote for dissolution. In this case, the members of both groups were the same. On May 12, 1924, Dr. Brown called a meeting of the original governors, herself and Dr. Carleton, Miss Greenfield being unable to attend, and some friends in an advisory capacity, and thereafter sent out a copy of an amended constitution. On July 10, meeting with the subcommittee, she went over this constitution with them, and agreement was reached on required changes. A letter was drawn up by the subcommittee to be sent out with the new constitution expressing their approval. The printing and dispatching of the new constitution was left to Dr. Brown. She sent it out in a form not approved by the subcommittee, thus misrepresenting their views, so the chairman could not poll the members of the general committee. The proposed new constitution was again brought before the executive committee on October 21, 1924, at which time it was received, discussed, and amended. The motion was made and unanimously passed that the new constitution sent out by Dr. Brown and as amended by the executive committee at this meeting be submitted to the general committee with a recommendation that it be approved as the constitution of a new society in whose favor we propose to dissolve. The original board of governors and members of the society voted in favor of the new constitution and new society, as did the members of the general committee. The new society, which was called the Women's Christian Medical College Society, was organized, and the memorandum of association was registered with the Registrar of Stock Companies for Punjab on December 17, 1924. The battle had been waged for 4 years. For Edith Brown, it was a bittersweet victory. Her personal religious faith had been the main point of contention, and in the final analysis, it was that faith which was officially established as the basis for all future students and staff. All would have to sign agreement to that basis of faith. However, the struggle had taken its toll. Staff members resigned, contributing societies were alienated, and the goodwill of many individual supporters was lost. The way ahead was dark. Would the miracle of God's grace continue to operate as in the earlier years?